In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. We all know that King Henry VIII found himself in a world of trouble trying to get out of his numerous marriages. But you might not be aware that we can actually trace the arc of royal divorce scandals right back to the 9th century. And a Carolingian ruler called Lothar II. Edinburgh University's Professor Charles West has explored this story of marital strife in his recent book, The Fall of a Carolingian Kingdom, Lotharingia 855 to 869. And he spoke to David Musgrove.
Today, I'm very pleased to be joined by Professor Charles West from Edinburgh University, who's author of a recent book entitled The Fall of a Carolingian Kingdom, Lotharingia 855 to 869. What we're talking about today is a scandal that unfolded in the reign of Lothar II in this Carolingian kingdom. But we'd better take stock before we dive in and try and situate ourselves a little bit. Can you paint a picture for us of the political makeup of Western and Northern Europe in the early 9th century, and tell us a little bit about the legacy of Charlemagne?
Absolutely, Dave. Charlemagne is, of course, the best known of the Carolingian rulers, mainly because he creates this huge empire. It's about 1 million square kilometres. So it's Charlemagne who expands the Frankish lands to include Bavaria and Saxony, and also, of course, Northern Italy. So he creates this massive empire, which territorially dominates Western Europe. So that's why he's such a big, imposing figure at the time, as well as also historiographically.
Okay, so we've got our bearings there. We're going to talk, as I said, about the reign of Lothar II. So we need to understand him. Can you tell us how he came to power and where and when did he reign?
So Lothar is a descendant of Charlemagne. So what happens with Charlemagne's empire is that it is divided amongst his heirs. It's a dynasty. As I said earlier, he's the most famous ruler of the Carolingian dynasty. As it happened, Charlemagne has only one son called Louis, but Louis's got several sons, and each of them makes a claim to be a kind of king, or in fact, one of them becomes an emperor in his own right. And so Lothar's actually a great grandson of Charlemagne. So he's in this family, but he is a king of a kind of little separate part of what had been the United Empire. So his father is someone called Lothar I, which is why he's called Lothar II, and he stakes a claim to a third of Lothar I's kingdom. So in other words, he's ruling over a fraction of Charlemagne's empire. I should stress, it is quite a big kingdom. Charlemagne's empire was, of course, massive, so even a fraction of Charlemagne's empire is pretty big. The kingdom that Lothar II rules over, we now call after him Lotharingia, it's about the same size as modern England, so it's a fairly large unit.
Okay, so we're talking about an environment here where a previously very large empire has fractured somewhat, and presumably there's lots of competing tensions. How strong a position was Lothar in as a ruler when he came to power, would you say?
Well, I think you're on something very important there, Dave, because one of the key points is that because all these descendants of Charlemagne stake their claims legitimacy on being descended from Charlemagne, that means they can all kind of make a claim to each other's kingdom, if you see what I mean. So all these political boundaries at the time are very temporary, you might say, provisional might be a better way of putting it. So it is a very competitive environment to be a king. Lothar becomes king. He's got relatives surrounding him with their own kingdoms, and they're all kind of looking at his kingdom with watchful eyes, as, of course, he is on them. Everything's up for grabs in this period. He starts with some advantages. He's got an alliance with one of his uncles, king we call Louis the German, who rules essentially what's East Francia, so the eastern part of Charlemagne's former empire. His main disadvantage, I think, Dave, is that he's quite young. He's a young man. I mean, he's in late teens, basically, by the time he comes to power. So I think he's ambitious. He's got a lot of energy, but he's also very inexperienced. And I think we can see that play out in the early part of his reign.
So it sounds like you need to be quite an astute political operator to survive and thrive in this sort of environment and not embroil yourself in a scandal, ideally. However, that's what happens. So can you tell us, what was the scandal that dominated his reign?
So the scandal that dominates his reign begins really in 857. So Lothar becomes king in 855, which is when his father Lothar I dies. As part of his claim to assert himself as king, he marries into a very influential family, and he marries a woman called Teutberger, and that happens already in 855. In 857, though, I think what's happening is that Lothar II is beginning to find his feet, and he decides he doesn't really like Teutberger anymore. Maybe he never really had. Doesn't like her family. Maybe he never really had. And he just sends her away. And what he wants to do instead is marry someone else, a woman called Waldrada, who it seems almost certain he already had a relationship with before his marriage to Teutberger. And so this seems a simple thing. It turns out to be anything but. This is the scandal then which dominates the rest of his reign, because when his first efforts to just get rid of Teutberger without any fuss go badly wrong, he has to try to find a justification for doing this. And in the course of doing so, he makes outrageous slurs against Teutberger's character and her past in order to justify trying to get rid of her and marry someone else. And it's this entanglement, I guess, in this divorce scandal, and in particular, say, the slasher's accusations which are made against Teutberger, which really set the scene for what unfolds later.
Okay, so we'll drill into that in a bit more detail in a second. But I just wonder, how much do we know about these two women, Teutberger and Waldrada? So you mentioned that Teutberger is part of this important noble family. Do we know much more about her? And do we know much about Waldrada's background?
So we don't know as much as we'd like about either, Dave, unfortunately, but we know more than you might expect. What we don't have from either of these women is direct testimony. We know they did write some. We know for certain Teutberger wrote several letters. We know for certain Teutberger could read, by the way, and we're pretty sure Waldrada could as well. But we don't have those letters from them themselves. But what we do have, though, is quite a lot of information written about them, some of which, especially about Waldrada, is written by her enemies. We need to be a little bit careful about that. They portray Waldrada as a woman who's pulling the strings in the background. We need to be, you know, thinking about how that's being framed. But yeah, we do know a little bit about them. So Teutberger indeed comes from a very powerful family. We know about her brother, who's called Hubert, who is a powerful figure around the Alps, essentially. And actually, she's got family members right across the former Carolingian Empire, including in Italy. Waldrada's a bit more mysterious, which probably means she comes from a slightly lower social background, but I think probably still aristocratic would be my reading on this. Teutberger is certainly from a more politically influential family. Waldrada is, I think, not quite so powerful initially.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And in your book, you mentioned that the use of love magic was suspected to explain Lothar's attachment to Waldrada. Can you tell us a bit more about that and how you understand what that might mean?
So the key thing here is that throughout his reign, Lothar insists on trying to marry Waldrada. And this is, even though this becomes politically more and more difficult, but he kind of hews to this very strongly. And including, at one point, he's given the option saying, well, you might be able to marry again, you might be able to divorce Teutoburger, but you can never marry Waldrada. And that just is not a possibility for him. So it has to be Waldrada. And it's for this reason, I think, that we see contemporaries hinting, and in fact, sometimes saying that Waldrada is clearly has got a hold over him, which they ascribe to love magic. For us now, I mean, that sounds a little bit like a way of criticising Lothar, saying that he's susceptible maybe to a woman's kind of sorcery. Contemporaries took this seriously, though. One of the key players in this scandal, as it unfolds over the whole decade, really, is a Frankish archbishop named Hincmar, who is Archbishop of Reims in what's West Francia, so actually outside Lothar's own kingdom. And he writes a treatise and intervenes several times in the course of the dispute and this scandal. And he takes this question of love magic very seriously. He says, yeah, absolutely, it exists. It's a thing. Women do sometimes use incantations and spells in order to make men fall in love. But don't worry, he says, the church has remedies for this. And with prayer, we can kind of break through these spells. So I guess what I would say is we can see from this love magic accusation, this is a serious accusation. I think people are wondering what is going on. How can we explain the fact that Lothar seems prepared really to risk a lot, almost all his political capital, indeed the survival of his kingdom, on marriage to this one particular woman? And love magic is a possibility people are exploring. I think they're doing so seriously.
So Lothar, at the start of this scandal, it sounds like he assumes that he can just get rid of Teutoburger. He thinks that he will just be able to palm her off without any repercussions. But there are repercussions. People push back on it. What happens?
So I think, just to pick up on your first point there, absolutely right. I'm sure that Lothar, when he first actually say he puts Teutoburger aside in 857, I think he thinks he can get away with it. Charlemagne had got away with it after all, coming back to him. He had dismissed a Lombard wife, and the Merovingian kings of Francia before the Carolingians had pretty routinely really just set wives aside when they no longer wanted them. So it's a standard thing. I think Lothar thought he was doing the traditional thing, but times had changed, times had moved on, and he found that doing what had been traditional was now becoming very difficult. And I think that's partly, of course, because of Teutoburger's family, who I mentioned are very powerful. But it's also partly, I think, because ideas about marriage were changing, and in particular, the idea of divorce. This was becoming much more complicated, less taken for granted as a possibility. So what happens, first of all, is that he subjects her to a trial by ordeal to substantiate these outrageous allegations about her. He accuses her of incest and sodomy and abortion. And he demands that she undertake a trial by ordeal to clear herself of these allegations. This is in 858. And to everybody's amazement, certainly Lothar's, she passes the trial by ordeal. So that's the first massive setback, in that he's put these allegations to her. He's staged a trial by ordeal. This is a trial by hot water, where she, actually a champion, because Teutoburger is a queen, we can't expect her to do that. Her champion puts his hand inside a cauldron of boiling water to retrieve an object. And for some reason, which we can't really understand now, the champion's hand comes out and is uncooked, as the sources of the time describe it. So that's the first major setback. He's tried to get rid of her and she's cleared her name. But he doesn't give up. So after that, he moves tactics. He thinks, okay, fine, I cut the trial by ordeal, didn't work. What's my next plan? He then orchestrates in 860, just a couple of years later, a church council. So he then puts the question to his bishops. So the trial by ordeal is a secular form of judgment. When that doesn't work, he moves to the church.
Can we just stop a second on that trial by ordeal? I mean, that's very surprising, is that her champion manages to stick his hand in the cauldron and come out unscathed. What do you understand of that particular incident? Do you imagine that it did actually happen like that?
It's a very interesting question. It's a very interesting subject, the trial by ordeal. What is going on there is, well, to begin with, contemporaries are also bothered by this. So Hincmar, who I mentioned earlier, talks quite a lot about how it might have gone wrong, how the ordeal might perhaps have given the wrong result. Hincmar and others are strong proponents of the trial by ordeal. That is to say, they think absolutely God can intervene directly. When you pray in the right way, then God, you know, can change the rules of nature, actually, to show innocence. But Hincmar concedes that maybe the devil can sometimes throw things off. Okay, so Hincmar talks about ways in which the trial by ordeal in 858 might have been disrupted by secular agents or by Teutberger's cunning. Maybe she was thinking of someone else. When they said, did you have incest with Hubert? Maybe she thought of a different Hubert, right? And that's how she was able to pass it, or a champion was able to pass it, or just that there was diabolical intervention. I think the other point we need to remember with the trial by ordeal is that ultimately, lots of it is quite subjective, actually. When someone withdraws their hand from boiling water, and it's often we assume then it's left to heal for a bit, and the question is really, is it healing properly? That's a very subjective question, isn't it? And if Lothar's court or his supporters are maybe not so keen on what he's trying to do, you can imagine they could easily say, yeah, looks fine to me, looks good.
Okay, so what happens when the church council gets involved then? Presumably they all say, oh, Lothar, you're right, you can do what you like.
So he takes it to church council, and the problem is that the laws about marriage in the 9th century, about Christian marriage in the 9th century, are not entirely clear. And in particular, there's this question of, can you remarry, essentially? And the reason for this lack of clarity is that, really, these Frankish bishops, they're looking back at the sources from late antiquity, so that's, say, from the period of the Christian Roman Empire. And these sources, they don't always cohere. They don't always say the same thing. So the bishops are actually, in a way, given a bit of a problem when Lothar says, OK, so, you know, I'm passing this over to you. They go down the line that there's a bit of church tradition which says that someone who has committed incest is incapable of marriage. So that's the line they take. So in 860, there's a church council where essentially they say that, well, Teutberger confesses, they stage a confession, where she says, in a different version of this confession, actually, which is itself quite interesting, but essentially she confesses to the accusation of incest. And the bishops say, well, in that case, you're not really capable of being married at all. What that doesn't do, though, is give Lothar permission to marry again, because it's not clear that, having been married once, can you actually remarry? If Teutberger is sent to a monastery for the rest of her life, which I think was the intention, does that mean that Lothar is free to marry? So they have another church council in 862, so Lothar has to wait a bit longer. And in that council, Lothar actually pleads with the bishops. He appears before them barefoot, and in a quavering voice he says, you've put me in this terrible position. You've forbidden me from having a wife, Teutberger. I'm not allowed to be married anymore. I'm a young man. I need to be married. You have, as bishops, you've got to help me here. And I think we can maybe see that staging as a way of trying to shortcut some of the canon law complications around marriage. He's framing it really as a pastoral question. You know, if you don't let me marry, I will fall into worse sin. I'll fall into fornication and all these kinds of things, and it'll be your fault, basically, if that happens. So that's how it's framed. But say the bishops are, there's some discomfort, I think, and they're stretching the rules and they're trying to find legal resources and also biblical precedents to enable them to get the result which Lothar wants.
So how far is this whole thing partly the result of Teutberger's response? The fact that she didn't just slope off and go to a nunnery as perhaps Lothar hoped and expected would happen, that she herself pushed back. I wonder what it tells us about the agency of women, particularly high-ranking women during this period.
So both these women that I'm talking about here, Teutberger and Waldrada, are full of unexpected decisions, actually. They are really assessing the agenda, actually. They're not just being passive recipients. Teutberger runs away in 860. So after she's made to confess these terrible sins with her brother, she disappears, she vanishes, and she runs off to Lothar's uncle, who is one of these uncles who's Lothar's neighbours and is kind of interested in what's going on here, and she gets refuge with him. Later, she is made to rejoin Lothar. We might come to this later in 865. Lothar is made to take her back, and she demands again. She says, I want to be given the chance to clear my name because I'm innocent of these things. On that occasion, Lothar doesn't let her do it. And then she writes several times to the Pope, actually probably already in 859, certainly in 860, and certainly again in 862. So she's also writing to the Pope in Rome to say, this is what's happened to me, it's unjust and unfair. We don't have those letters, but we've got the replies to her, so we know she's doing that. As for Waldrada, there's this wonderful moment in 866 when, as I said, in the end, and we'll come back to this point, I expect, Lothar is made to take Teutberga back as his queen, having tried to get rid of her. Waldrada is kind of sent away from court, and actually she's summoned to Rome. A papal legate is supposed to accompany her to Rome, where she's going to be judged by the Pope, but she runs away. En route, she and another woman, actually called Engeltrude, they take some horses, and it's very Thelma and Louise. They just escape. They refuse to go halfway to Rome. They simply run away. So you can see how these women I've been talking about are absolutely not doing what they're told.
So you just mentioned the Pope there and the Pope's involvement in this scandal. You talk about in the book that there's a reference from Regino of Prum, who suggests that the Pope cursed Lothar and his kingdom. What's going on?
Okay, so what happens is in 860, as I said, after the trial by ordeal fails, in 860, Lothar arranges a council which declares that Teutberga is unfit to be his queen. In 862, he gets another church council which says, you're now free to marry, which he does, by the way. And so Waldrada, he marries her at some point in 862, and we see her appear in some of his charters as his wife. However, in 862, the Pope, who has been hearing about this for a long time, as I mentioned, Teutberga writes to him quite early on, and it's clear also that Lothar's uncles are also taking a very keen interest in this affair, and they're keeping the Pope up to speed as well. So what happens in 862 is that the Pope finally intervenes, and what he does is he sends a letter to Lothar, several letters actually, saying, I hear there are some problems with your marriage. You've held these councils, but I'm not satisfied. I want you to hold another council with my legates also being present so they can really judge it on my behalf. And that council takes place in 863, and the papal legates are present. And Lothar, who's obviously very good at persuading people to do what he wants, the papal legates agree, actually, to what he wants. So the council takes place in the city of Metz, now in France, in 863, and they declare that, yes, he is married to Waldrada, and that's all fine. And it's clear that in exchange for this, Lothar agrees to undertake some kind of church reform in the kingdom. Anyway, the legates then go back to Rome, as do some of Lothar's bishops, with the results of this council. And Pope Nicholas goes completely berserk. This is not what he wanted. He's astonished that this is the outcome. He deposes Lothar's bishops who have come to Rome, just like that. And he annuls the council. And he writes some extraordinary angry letters to Lothar, and he copies them. He sends letters also about this case to all the other Frankish kings, saying, this is an utter disgrace and this cannot be allowed to stand. He never quite goes as far to excommunicate Lothar, although he threatens to, and at one stage says, I'm treating him as if I've excommunicated him. He does, though, excommunicate Waldrada. And so there's this historian around the year 900 who's reading these papal letters, actually, from Nicholas I, who's a very energetic pope, and he looks at what happens to Lotharingia, and he says, this is a curse, basically. And if you look at some of the language which Nicholas is using, he condemns Lothar for yielding to, you know, the agitations of his body in a way which is not suitable for a king. His language is very strong. So for the Regina of Prüm, writing early 10th century, he looks back and it looks a bit like a papal curse. We don't these days see the fall of Lotharingia as a result of Pope Nicholas's curse, but actually the papal intervention was absolutely key, I think, in further destabilising Lothar's reign.
So there's extraordinary scenes there, isn't there, with the high drama of the Pope deposing the bishops there and then, and it becoming an international scandal by the sound of things. So it becomes a very significant event. So how does it play out? Do Lothar's royal relatives continue to try to exploit the situation?
So they've been exploiting the situation from quite an early date. There's a wonderful meeting between three Carolingian kings, so three relatives of descendants of Charlemagne, including Lothar, where one of Lothar's uncles at this meeting essentially says, I'm not going to talk to Lothar II until he basically apologises and promises to do much better and sort things out. And you can already see that these kings are kind of jostling. They're always jostling for the high moral ground. And Lothar is increasingly putting himself in a very sticky position relative to his relatives. And this continues and accelerates, really. There's a meeting actually between two of Lothar's uncles quite late on in his reign. They actually meet in his kingdom without him, and discuss how they might be able to divide up his kingdom were he to die without a legitimate heir. And of course, he hasn't got any children with Teuberger. And if that's the person he's married to, then that means he won't have any legitimate heirs. So you can see how these kings are positioning themselves to take advantage, to show that they are the morally upstanding kings. They therefore have a better claim, I guess, to rule than Lothar. The same uncle I mentioned before, King Charles of West Francia, sometimes called Charles the Bald, in 866, he actually orchestrates a new coronation of his queen, Ermentrude, whose main function, I think, is just to say, look, my queen and I've got a proper queen. We're getting on very well. This is a kind of holy union, and it casts shadows even more strongly on what's going on in Lotharingia, just over the border.
What happens in the end then? What happens to everybody involved? What happens to Lothar? What happens to Teutberger? What happens to Waldrada?
So this divorce drags on, as I said, more or less for a decade from 858, really, is when it really kicks off with that failed trial by ordeal. We've got these church councils and papal legates and kings plotting and conniving around each other. What happens in the end is that Pope Nicholas dies. And Pope Nicholas has always been a big problem for Lothar because he's absolutely insistent that, you know, he's a stickler for the rules. He says, under no circumstances can Lothar remarry, especially not ever Waldrada. He dies, 867. Lothar thinks, OK, fine, maybe there's a chance with a new pope, who's a man called Hadrian II, who actually does seem to be a little bit more willing to compromise. So he goes to see him, and the pope actually agrees to talk to him. And the pope does various things. He actually restores communion to the archbishops Nicholas had deposed. So there's various kind of promising signs. Although nothing concrete, I must say, in terms of Teutberger. On the way back from seeing Hadrian, Lothar dies. He dies in the Italian town of Piacenza, probably from a fever or some sort of malaria or who knows what. In the height of summer, Italy in the early Middle Ages can be a dangerous place. He dies en route. His followers, those who also survive, there seems to be a bit of a dysentery perhaps going through the camp, those who survive just abandon his body and head home. They go straight back home. He's buried there in Piacenza, a very pleasant but quite small Italian town. There is no effort really to repatriate the corpse. He's left where he dies. And they do that because they are thinking, okay, we need to move on to what's going to happen next. Obviously, there's now going to be a scramble for Lotharingia, which is exactly what happens. King Charles the Bald invades, has himself crowned king in just a few weeks. He acts extraordinarily fast, and some people have wondered, seeing him, he acts so fast, people have said, surely this must have been pre-planned to some extent. However, actually, Charles has to share the kingdom in the end with the other uncle, Louis the German, because essentially Louis threatens war. As to the women, well, they both go to convents. Teutberger goes to a convent in Metz, and we know she lives for a few more years. And Waldrada goes to a convent in the Vosges Mountains, a place called Remiremont. So they both become nuns, or at least join the religious life. So that's what happens to those people. And the kingdom then is divided between the uncles, and that's it.
And that's it. So chunking out, big picture here, we've got this interesting, salacious scandal going on, which is one bit of it. But what does it tell us broadly about the nature of Frankish society and kingship during this period? Are there any sort of broad themes you would pull out that our listeners might want to take away to further their understanding of this story?
So I think the big picture here is that usually when we talk about the Carolingian Empire, historians, and not just them, focus on Charlemagne, as we did at the beginning, of course, and then the story of the Carolingian Empire becomes, you know, the rise and the kind of glory under Charlemagne. It's this huge empire, and then its gradual fragmentation, which maybe begins already under his direct heir, Louis the Pious, or maybe even under Charlemagne himself, and we essentially it becomes a story of disintegration and decay and of collapse, really. And I think what the case of Lothar II and these two women remind us is that there is a fragmentation of empire, absolutely right, but there's also a lot of creativity in terms of kingship and a lot of innovation. I mean, Lothar is doing extraordinary things with his kind of public displays of penance and his speeches and his use of bishops and all these other things. There's a lot of inventiveness, I think, happening in late Carolingian political culture. And we can see here ideas of kingship are being kind of developed. So they're being people are thinking about how to project kingship in a competitive environment. And yeah, these are legacies which are being laid out, which will keep running throughout the Middle Ages.
And finally, it's a very short-lived kingdom under Lothar. Are there any sort of further echoes of Lotharingia that still exist today, that live on today?
So the kingdom does indeed die with Lothar. His son, I should have mentioned earlier, he has several children with Waldrada, three daughters and a son. The son is called Hugh, and Hugh makes a claim to Lothar's kingdom, his father's kingdom, in the 880s. It ends quite badly, I'm afraid. He is eventually captured and blinded, actually, and becomes a monk, and that's where he ends his days. So, yeah, the kingdom itself never really revives. The name, of course, survives in the French region of Lorraine. So Quiche Lorraine is actually named after King Lothar II. So there's a nugget for all the listeners. As a territorial unit, this area in between West Francia and East Francia becomes a bit of a kind of political football. We see kings successively really right through the Middle Ages, and the kings of these areas are contesting and claiming to rule the lands in between the Lotharingian kingdoms. So we can see politically echoes of this political failure right through the Middle Ages. And in terms of cultural influences, I mean, it is true that the case of Lothar II is not itself widely discussed later, but it nonetheless is true that this is the first time that the laws of Christian marriage have really posed a significant problem to rulers. And it's not the last time, but it's the first time this happens. As I said earlier, Charlemagne gets rid of a wife without any complications. As far as we can see, Merovingian kings did it all the time. With Lothar II, everyone realises, okay, this is not straightforward anymore. Something's changed. Times have changed. And we see then these questions about royal divorces. You know, this is the starting point, I guess, for a grand series of controversies and scandals over royal divorces over the ensuing centuries.
Yes, and we talk about such things on the podcast quite a lot. So this is a nice precedent to all those things. One more thing before we finish. You've described a story here with great colour, great drama, lots of details. It's quite surprising that we've got this level of information. I know you're obviously not making it up. You're an esteemed historian. So we must have some pretty detailed and interesting sources for this, which is surprising for the period. Is it particularly well documented? And if so, why?
So I'd start off by saying there are absences. As I mentioned earlier, we know that Teutberger wrote letters and it would be wonderful to have them. And, you know, if only, but we don't. So there are things we know were produced which don't survive. So we certainly don't have a complete picture of what happened. But nonetheless, yes, we do have a very good picture, actually. Nonetheless, it is pretty well documented, especially for such a remote period in time. And I think there are two reasons for that. I think one of them is linked to the figure I mentioned earlier, Hincmar, the Archbishop of Reims. Hincmar took great care to document his activities and he kept his own archive, and much of that has survived to the present day. So a lot of what we see about Lothar's divorce is refracted through Hincmar of Reims's writings. So he writes lots of the texts which relay the details. Fascinating, I think, one side of it. I think the second reason is that this is, after all, Dave, the period, some of the listeners may have heard of the concept of the Carolingian Renaissance. A lot of these arguments about Teutberger, about the marriage, are being expressed through textual argument, actually. And so we see here politics is being articulated through writings of different kinds. So there was a lot of writing about this case at the time. I think there were letters flying around all over the place. There was more, in other words, to produce at the time, which means, yeah, that more survives to this day. So it's not a complete picture, but I think because it was such a textualised scandal at the time, that means that more survives for us to look at today.
And I guess it just tells us that people are forever interested in scandal, salacious details. It's not a new thing. People have always been interested in that.
Absolutely right. One of the details earlier is that Hincmar of Reims says at one point, you know, this scandal is so bad that even the peasants are talking about this case in the weaving sheds. So it has everybody is gossiping about this. So yes, absolutely right.
That was Charles West. His book, The Fall of a Carolingian Kingdom, Lotharingia, 855 to 869, is out now, published by the University of Toronto Press. You can hear more from Charles in another History Extra podcast, where he looks at the key turning points in early medieval Europe. That's available on the History Extra website and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.